Crater Lake is a marvel. A sharp intake of breath at the first sight of that deep blue water is common, and that's after a trip of, I don't know, maybe 2 hours by road from Medford. It once took a whole lot longer to arrive at the rim of the lake, and that involved camping on the way there and on the way back, and not camping like we know it today. Today's guest prepared a presentation about historical camping at Crater Lake. He'll deliver it to an audience in Medford on Saturday. Larry Smith is no stranger to the Jefferson Exchange. He taught school for years in Jacksonville, helped start the system of trails around that city under the Jacksonville Woodlands Association, and continues to take an interest in the current and past workings of the region. We assume the future, too. Larry Smith, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Very good to have you. Let's talk about you. First, you're working as a volunteer at Crater Lake, as if you weren't busy enough to begin with.
Well, I started out working for money up there in 1961 and did that for 23 summers and partially during the winter. And then after I retired and so forth, they came up with a volunteer program, and we're always looking for winter volunteers. And so I run the winter volunteer program at Crater Lake, doing the same thing I used to get paid for.
How'd they figure that one out?
The schedule is better.
Uh-huh. Is it?
Yes.
In the winter?
Yeah, because I can go at my leisure, and then I have 30 volunteers that we use to work in the visitor center up there.
And so you just staff the visitor center for the folks
yes.
who come up there in the winter?
Yeah, on weekends mostly.
All right, which is obviously far less than far lower than the numbers that come in the summertime.
Yes, but with a low snow year, we were packed.
Were you really?
Yeah, we had some days we couldn't even find parking.
At Crater Lake in the wintertime?
Yes, in the wintertime.
Really?
Yes, during Christmas time, it was packed all the way down, and we couldn't find, there was no place to park.
So you've lived a bunch of the history at Crater Lake yourself, been connected to it for more than 50 years now.
Well, I wrote a history about Crater Lake called The Smith Brothers Chronological History, and it's amazing. Half of that is my history, or it happened while my twin brother and I were there.
And so what got you to look at the camping aspect of things up at Crater Lake?
Well, of course, going into Crater Lake itself, the only way you could stay there historically was through camping. And then, especially during the 1960s when I first started working there, camping was free. And we made every effort to get people into the park. And we would they started building extra campgrounds. We had Mazama built during that time. We had the Rim Campground. And if those filled up, we had overflow campgrounds that we'd put people in. We called it the boonies or boondocks. And then when that filled up, we would put people personally out into the picnic areas alongside the road. We thought nothing. If you showed up, you had a place to park. But quickly they realized they were loving the resource to death. The forests were getting trampled. And so it became, by the 1970s, things were brought in and they started putting limits. And now I think it's $25 a night. That limits quite a few people.
It would indeed. So that's interesting. Things were getting pretty well beat up.
The old yes, thing. They were.
It's almost Yosemite-like, it sounds like.
It was.
So let's go back in time, because we're not talking about our own lifetimes here. We're talking generally about way, way back in time. And there are some pictures, including the one we posted on our website, of camping at Crater Lake, on the way to Crater Lake, which looks like it's, I'm going to guess, 1860s maybe?
Well, they were taking pictures. They didn't take any pictures up there until the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
So the pictures you would have to be, like this picture here I have posted is, I'm guessing, about 1880, judging from the styles.
Two women in a covered wagon with very high wheels, very long dresses.
Yeah, and they always went in two wagons. One was a lighter wagon for the people to ride in, and then the second wagon with a heavier team would be the one pulling provisions. We're talking about 2 weeks to a month to go from Jacksonville to Crater Lake and back again.
Really? At a minimum, 2 weeks then?
Yes. And they could go a little faster if they wanted to, but there was a lot of, let's enjoy it mm-hmm. while we're at it. And the best story ever written on this was Fletcher Lynn's diary that he did in 1889. And he talks about all the stuff that they were doing and how they put it together and what they did after they got to each camping site. And if they'd find a nice camping site, they'd just say, hey, let's hold off here for 2 or 3 days and enjoy it.
So let's talk about the history of people using Crater Lake as the resource we've come to know it now. I mean, first of all, when did white settlers first start visiting the lake?
Well, 1854. That was the John Wesley Chauncey Nye group. And, of course, when they got up there, they were looking for gold, and they found a lake. So it was nice. They named it. They knew it Deep Blue Lake, and then just went on their way. And nobody ever wrote anything down until years later. That's when Hillman started writing about it. And it wasn't until 1864 that a mining party from back eastern Oregon stumbled upon it. And they named Union Creek at that Union Creek and Union Peak. They were obviously sympathizers
for
the Union
North
side.
Cause, yeah.
Yeah, and then 1869 was when the group from the Jim Sutton party from Jacksonville went up there. And that was when David Lynn was with them. And David Lynn is the father of Fletcher Lynn, who came along in 1889 and wrote that great diary about the trip. And so they put a boat on it in 1869, went over to the island, and really did some exploring. And that's when Jim Sutton went back to Jacksonville and wrote about the story and the experience, and he used the word Critter Lake in print for the first time. There was no big deal. It just suddenly had been Lake Majesty, Hole in the Ground, Deep Blue Lake, Lake Mystery, all these other lakes. And then suddenly Critter Lake shows up in print, and so that became the name, and he never explained where he got it, why he named it that. So I did some research and looking up Jim Sutton's obituary, which was here in the Ashland Tidings, and it said he named Critter Lake, and that's all it said.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know. But these people, of course, were camping, and when you were camping in those days, you had to have a spot where there was water. You couldn't camp up on the rim very easily because there's no water up there.
Oh, right.
So they were doing it down either at Annespring or Annie Spring, as we call it now, at Munson Spring or over at Dutton Spring. There were three campgrounds, and that's where they were camping. And the campgrounds varied by season because as you came in, you stopped over at White Horse Creek first. There was water there, no snow.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the snow moved, you moved up to Annie Spring, and then you moved up to Munson Spring and Dutton Spring, and then finally to the rim.
All right, getting water up at Crater Lake, a trick even back then. We're talking to Larry Smith, who's got some history with Crater Lake and knows quite a bit of the history of Crater Lake. We'll come back and talk more with him about some history at Crater Lake and the history of camping there as well and camping on the way to it. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Larry Smith and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Larry Smith, longtime teacher in Jacksonville and historian and Crater Lake volunteer. And there are just so many more titles we could give him. We'll just let that list suffice for now. He is delivering a program later this week about camping at Crater Lake and camping on the way to Crater Lake. It was quite a long trip back in the day, and we're talking the 19th century. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange about Crater Lake and its history and the process of getting there. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go back even a little further than Pioneer Times. You mentioned that that people couldn't actually camp right at the rim itself because there's no water up there. They have to camp at the springs down below. Native Americans, did they live very close to Crater Lake?
Yes, because we had at least four Indian tribes, and that would be the Klamaths, the Modocs, the Umpquas, the Rogues, and the Kilmas, so actually five, lived in the area. And it seemed like the Cascade Mountains were the kind of dividing line. They didn't seem to mix too much. But one thing that brought them up there were the huckleberries. And even the white folk in the 1880s and 1890s talked about the Indians coming back with gallons and gallons of huckleberries. They'd come over from Klamath, come over to the Whiskey Springs area, west of the mountain, pick their huckleberries there, and then head back over. And on the way, they would sell them to the tourists, the so-called tourists that were coming up there. And so the Indians, according to Fletcher Lynn's diary, there's a comment in there. He said that the Indians were very afraid, very suspicious of going up to the mountain because it was a revered place. But by 1889, he said they were over it, and they were up there selling huckleberries on the rim.
So I'm still struck by the story of the first white person who is recorded as having seen Crater Lake, that he just saw it and called it Deep Blue Lake and moved on. I mean, I know he was in search of gold from what you said, but was he hungry too or just late for something? Because I can't imagine not at least spending a little time there to catch your breath after seeing that amazing sight.
On that particular expedition, there were 22 people. And after a week, 11 went back to Jacksonville. 11 continued on. And then there were three or four in the party that actually went over the crest and saw the lake. And in searching for gold, that was all they could be thinking about. And also, they were hungry. You were in the diary, they talk about being hungry. And that was one of the things that forced them to go back to Jacksonville. Hillman talks about the walls were so steep, nobody could ever climb down to the water. So they made no attempt to. Mm-hmm. But the next parties that went up there, they all climbed down. And that was really a big deal.
And you mentioned a boat on the lake by 1869.
Yes.
I could just imagine what a feat that must have been, because it's a pretty tricky trail down to the lake at Cleetwood Cove now.
It was a foldable boat. David Lynn had built it using a framework that came apart, and then he put a canvas bag around it, and they went out in this canvas bag. It wasn't a real rowboat, as we think about mm-hmm. it. It was a foldable boat, but quite ingenious.
Really?
Yes. Yeah,
it's innovative for its time.
And they went over to the island and climbed the island and shot off their guns.
There's something to be said about that. Grab your headphones. We have a phone call for you. We're talking to Larry Smith about Crater Lake's history in settler times, white settler times, and camping up there as well. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. I love camping. So I asked your guest, I live in Grants Pass. How long would it take me to have gotten to the lake? How many days? And I don't know much about horses, but how many miles can a horse do pulling a wagon in, let's say, one day? So I'm guessing it might take me quite a while to get there, but back in those days. And then I know that right next to the rim, man, it is steep, really steep, when you go up to actually where the lodge is now. So anyway, along, and how would the horses do? Thanks.
All right. Thanks, John.
In 1869, the one I was reading about in great detail, they traveled 9 to 11 miles a day. And they would sometimes the roads were very rough, sometimes they're real fine. But the thing that really dictated where they stopped was the stream. They had to find the water, and they had to find feed for the horses. So from Grants Pass, just guess 100 miles, and that would be 10 miles a day. And so you can do the math. Just sure. Getting up there would be about 10 days. Also, they would use a light wagon, so they had more spirited horses for the light wagon. Then they would have more of a draft horse for the heavier provision wagon, and that slowed them down. Now, getting up to the rim, they would stop at Dutton Spring or Munson Spring, and then would walk the rest of the way. But there is one mention, Fletcher Lynn took the light wagon the last day they were there, and they managed to struggle it up the top because Carrie was sick. And she wanted to see the lake one more time before they left because the others had been walking. So they managed to struggle with the light horses and the light wagon. They did get to the top, but they couldn't stay there because, again, no water.
When I think about the way up to the lake now, I mean, it's just so easy to take for granted. You drive your way up in the car. And, yes, there are some hairpin turns and things on that last road from park headquarters up to the mm-hmm. rim. But I can't imagine there was much in the way of improved roads, not only at the lake itself, but also much on the way to it.
No, it was the dust on the pumice that they were talking about that really slowed the wagons down. In fact, when the roads were first built, they just left the stumps right in the road. They didn't want to take the trouble of knocking them out, so the wagons had to be high enough to go over the stumps. And so getting there was a struggle, of course. And I remember Fletcher Lynn talks about one time, they always let the horses, when they camped, they'd let the horses just run loose and go find its own feed. And then they went to go tie them up, and the horses were gone, heading for Jacksonville.
They were going home?
Yes. And so they took out after them, but with no flashlights, they couldn't follow. So after about 4 miles, they stopped, turned around, came back. Next morning, they were up at daylight and headed out again. And they finally found them heading for Jacksonville, and they corralled them and brought them back. But they said they'd gone to bed pretty depressed because they might have been stuck there until they could find more horses. So at least our cars didn't wander away during the night.
That's right. And yeah, don't have to send them off in search of their own gasoline or something. So how long after people began to visit Crater Lake before there were any amenities established up there? I mean, you mentioned that the campgrounds were still fairly primitive even into the 50s, it sounds like, or at least you could camp in places that weren't improved at that time.
Will Steele, who is the founder of Critter Lake, mm-hmm. considered to be the father, it became a national park in 1902, which is now the fifth oldest national park. As soon as he became superintendent and was involved in the early years of Critter Lake, he said there had to be provisions. Of course, people were camping, and the park didn't have anything to do with that, but he wanted cabins established. And immediately, as soon as he was able to get some permission from the government and so on, he started building cabins, and here are the cabins and tents and so forth.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and Larry's showing a picture of some cabins and tents right there in a flat somewhere in Crater Lake Park.
Yeah, it's right at the entrance. But he said that there had to be a hotel up there. And so he started working on that, and he got some business people from Portland to come down and managed to get a hotel established, Mr. Parkhurst. And right after it was built, the director of the National Park Service came by, and he said he didn't mind the bad food, uh-huh. didn't mind the dusty roads, didn't mind the bed bugs, but he sure minded the three other people in his bed.
Really? It was like that?
Yes.
Oh, wow. We take a lot for granted in our time that were just luxuries for people in the 19th century.
And one of the things they did move all over the place. Mm-hmm. They had no compulsion about knocking down the vegetation and cutting down trees. If there was snow on the ground, you'd slide a whole tree and burn it as a campfire.
Ah.
And my dad talked about doing that up in Montana, too. So
just light the tree on fire standing there?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And get warmed up and burn all night and have light at your forest.
Wow, that's amazing stuff. We're talking about Crater Lake in its primitive days, before it became the national park we know today, Oregon's only national park. Larry Smith is the winter volunteer leader at Crater Lake, and a historian and teacher and so much more. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Swap some stories about sites you've seen at Crater Lake over the years. 800-838-3760, our phone number anywhere in the region. 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about the pumice dust on the roads up there. And I remember reading in early automobile days before the road was paved that the dust would get about hub deep on the cars. That would make it about, I don't know, we're talking, what, 8 to 12 inches deep?
Yes. And the hard thing was it was destroying the engines.
Oh, right.
And sometimes when they couldn't see where they were going, they'd hit a tree, they'd run into each other. The park had a water wagon. And horses, of course, mm-hmm. to wet this down. And that was their attempt to try to keep the dust down the best they could.
That would have made a muddy mess, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, the pumice wasn't too bad. It would harden the surface and make it pretty nice.
That's pretty amazing. So we're talking about the kinds of things you'd bring on a camping trip with you. And, you know, today, again, you could throw a tent and a cooler full of food in the car and pretty much call it good. But back then, given the length of time, when we just established probably 10 days from Grants Pass, for example, a two-week trip from either Jacksonville or Ashland, what kinds of provisions would you bring with you? I mean, you're talking, this is your household then for,
yes.
for 2 to 4 weeks.
I have a list right here. Just uh-huh. happened to have one in my my hands here. And it was this was for 7 people coming uh-huh. out of Jacksonville, including Carrie Beekman, who was a very famous person. They had 30 loaves of bread, 2 sacks of flour, because they baked their own pies along the way.
Wow.
5 packages of coffee, 1 package of tea, 35 pounds of sugar for
really?
2 weeks.
So they really were making pies.
Yeah, my wife informed me that back in those days they used a lot more sugar than we do now. You know, imagine that is 5 pounds per person.
That's a lot. That would not fit today's dietary guideline. How did they bake?
They had a stove with them.
Uh-huh.
They got pictures of stoves that they carried with them.
Wow.
And set it up. And rice, they had 70 pounds of potatoes and baking powder and syrup and 10 pounds of salt and dried apples and on it went. Dried plums, bacon, lard, crackers. And this was interesting, 80 patty cakes.
Patty cakes.
I have no idea.
Really? We don't know what patty cakes are.
I know what
the hands is. Yeah, we could probably duplicate that right here. But.
And they had mustard and pepper and apples.
But you mentioned that they got some stuff along the way, too.
Yes, and then in one day, while camping near Fish Lake, they picked up 154 trout. And they went looking for deer, never did get one, but they caught a lot of grouse. They had two guns with them, and they had lots of ammunition, and they had a pistol and a target shooting gun just for games, just to play in games. They had two real rifles. They had musical instruments with them. They had guitars. They had things. They put on plays to each other. They sang. They had Bibles with them, so every Sunday they would read the Bible and have a church service. And Sunday was reserved for bathing.
Mm-hmm.
You bathed one day a week, and they tried to get toward a camp or someplace where there was really good water. The women would go to one side of the camp, the men to the other side, and they'd bathe and then dress up the best they could, the women in the finest of all clothing, and then they'd have their church service out there in the middle of the forest.
I gather this is not something that the average person could do. So let's talk about some demographics here about who could afford the time and the expense of uprooting households. And it sounds like they literally brought everything but the kitchen sink along to Crater Lake. I mean, who could do this?
Well, of course, Carrie Beekman was the daughter of the richest man in Jacksonville. So
C.C. Beekman. Mm-hmm.
And they probably brought up a lot of the money for all this, paid for it. Fletcher Lynn was the son of a very prosperous cabinet maker there in town, so there was money in the family. The other guy that came along was a professor. He was a teacher at the school. He was the principal of the Jacksonville School, so the summer was off, so he had the time to do that. Probably not a lot of money. You had Carrie's cousin out of Dundee, New York, that was there, and they had money. So you're right. The families were quite well-to-do. But in talking to people, what I found out was you could have the poor people or the lower social class people. These were farmers, and they would gear their trip. Snow would melt.
Mm-hmm.
Crops were still ripening, and you'd have a two-week window here in the valley, your pears or your mm-hmm. wheat. And so there was no real hard work right then, so you always had the horses for plowing the fields. So let's just hitch them up. We have the wagons to get to town, so let's take off for Crater Lake. And Fletcher Lynn talks about seeing groups of people, large groups of people along the way camping.
Several families together. Or
yes,
something like that.
And they would entertain each other in the evening with their horns and cornets and guitars and banjos and so on.
It sounds almost like the pilgrimage to Canterbury or something, where they entertain each other with tales along the way.
And the two men were gymnasts, and so they would put on gymnastic presentations for the ladies. And these guys were 18, 19, 20, 21. They were fairly young, except the professor was older.
Oh, wow. So just all kinds of stuff they had to bring with them. I had to assume that some of the people who were making the trip up to Crater Lake with these heavily provisioned wagon trains were people who had probably come across the West as pioneers.
Yes, and he makes a comment that he runs across a camp of pioneers a mile from them at Lake of the Woods. And so they spent the evening with and he puts in quotes, the pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
So he may be referring, because he was born in Jacksonville, and all these people were born in Jacksonville or were born after the Oregon Trail. So I have a feeling that these must have been they were real pioneers.
So you mentioned the season in which the farmers could make the trip because there wasn't much to do with fields or orchards for a window there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also trying to hit a window at Crater Lake as well. I mean,
that was a snow year.
Well, so trying to hit the season at Crater Lake when there isn't snow flying can be rather tricky.
And in 1889, he makes a comment that there was no snow. And he marveled at the lack of snow. So it made it really easy to get up there. And this was in August. And he said normally Mount Pitt, it had not been named McLaughlin yet, but he makes a comment that all the snow was gone off of Mount Pitt. And that surprised him. He said Lake of the Woods was at its lowest ever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's only been looking at
right.
it for 20 years
right.
or less.
And this is 1889?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Boyd in Wolf Creek. He has a question about mosquito outbreak cycles at Crater Lake. He said he visited the rim a few years ago in July. Almost nobody was there. A few folks were in their cars. Mosquitoes were everywhere. What is the outbreak cycle? I heard every 10 to 15 years. That, again, from Boyd in Wolf Creek. What do you know about that?
Well, I worked there for 23 years and never saw the mosquitoes very bad, except along the streams and where the snow is melting. And we called them snow mosquitoes. And so the puddles of water right where it was melting is mm-hmm. where they were breeding. And once the snow was gone, we never had any problem. And we'd camp out and do all kinds of stuff in August and so on and not have the mosquitoes. Now, I went to, or Linda and I went down to Biscayne National Park and talk about mosquitoes down there.
Is that in Florida?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And those are real mosquitoes. I think we carried us away at night.
Right.
But at Critter Lake, to answer his question about the cycle, by the time the snow is gone, other than just around the springs and some of the wetter, boggy areas, there are no mosquitoes that I've seen.
And any midges ever get up there from Upper Klamath Lake, or is that purely an Upper Klamath Lake?
Yeah, they're brought in by cars.
They're plastered to the front of them.
Yeah, and you can't see the headlights or anything. No midges up there that I know of, but yes, down at the Klamath Lake area there.
All right, well, we'll have to talk about the midges at Klamath Lake on a different day. Larry Smith, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking about Crater Lake in the old days, the early days of tourism, and what it took to go camping at Crater Lake, and what a production it was, and literally a production in a few cases, and I'm going to stop saying literally now and go to this break. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange on the other side. Larry Smith with us. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Yeah. Yep, yep. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Crater Lake and tourism years ago and what it took to actually visit Crater Lake back in the days before automobiles and into the early automobile age, cars, trucks. The things that we take for granted these days couldn't make it to Crater Lake because they didn't exist yet. But lots of history here that Larry Smith is bringing with him, teacher, historian, and volunteer leader for the winter crew at Crater Lake. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, stories of your own experiences up at the Big Lake. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking primarily about what it was like to bring up wagon loads. When do we know the first car actually made it up to Crater Lake?
Well, according to my research, it is this gentleman it depends on how you do it. Some came under their own power. Others were hauled in by horses.
Uh-huh.
So the first horse-drawn car up there was about 1905, mm-hmm. 1906, right in there. And then Charlie True drove the first car from Medford to Crater Lake under its own power. And I had a chance to interview his son, who lives in Central Point. And he went to work for the National Park Service later on and was a mechanic and a bear feeder up there. There are a lot of pictures of him feeding bears and so forth. That was one of the things you did do up there, was to feed the bears.
Uh-huh. I see that. And what were they feeding them?
That particular one I'm showing you here is a milk. It's a baby bottle.
Baby bottle of milk, okay.
But no, it was garbage.
Really?
Garbage and meat.
Oh, so they probably had lots of issues then with bears getting around the camps in the early days at people camping at Crater Lake.
Oh, I've counted as many as 20 at one time in the park, around the garbage dump.
Really?
Yes. What they did in those early days, you had to entertain the visitors, and so they dug ditches, they had seats out there, and in the evenings they would bring the garbage out from the campsites and from the lodge, and they would actually feed the bears, and people would drag out their little Kodaks and take pictures.
Wow, times have changed just a bit in terms of environmental management of a national park.
But it took a long time. It wasn't until the 1970s before the Park Service decided to get a handle on it, close the garbage dumps.
Mm-hmm. And so where does the garbage from Crater Lake go now?
Goes to Klamath Falls.
Okay. So you mentioned 1905 for the first. I didn't hear the year on the time of first the first car made it up there without horse assist.
About 1914. Mm-hmm. You caught me off guard on that one. I have it all documented somewhere. But between 1905 and 19, what they were doing is these dealers in Medford and Klamath Falls were wanting to get their cars up there first so they could really advertise. And there was one picture I have in my program of 1915, and it's touted as the first car that season.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you couldn't be the first car up there, then you became the first car for the season. And most of the time they were drugged by a horse or something like that, still to get that final bit. They put chains on the cars to not only for the snow, but they had to put chains on the cars just to get them over that dust because, as you were talking about, the road going up there was really steep.
So when do we know that it was actually first possible to make a day trip or at least to get up there in a day, even if you were camping up there?
Well, Charlie True, my understanding is he did it all in one day, and it was about 8 hours,
mm-hmm.
between 6 and 8 hours. It took him about 4 hours to get up there once the roads were pretty well improved, and then going back. Now, most of them stayed overnight, but there were a few of these Barney Oldfields that were always constantly setting records. And you see in the newspaper, he made it in 8 hours, uh-huh. round trip. And then he made it in 6 hours. He made it in 4 hours.
Wow.
4 hours, that was after they paved it.
You know, and this brings up my own memory of being up at Crater Lake in the wintertime and seeing these two young ladies show up in a Corvette with California plates and step out in very unseasonable shoes for the winter and get on the payphone up there and say, "We're in Crater Lake." "No, Oregon." "I don't know, we just felt like a drive up here." It was a much bigger production back then. Grab your headphones. We have some phone calls for you. Here is Dean in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're swapping Crater Lake stories with historian Larry Smith. Welcome, Dean.
Yeah, I just couldn't help but call because I have in my memory the time that I went up with a group of boys, including my son, and we spent the night up there. But the most dramatic thing took place. The ranger was telling the history of the lake, and it was just grand, and the moon came out just like he ordered it to come out during the time that he was telling the story, and it just made such a great impression on everyone that was there. And I don't know how they did it, but it was a great job, and I'll never forget it.
Did you ask him later on if he had the time of moonrise carefully recorded?
He must have. Yeah, it seemed like it. No, it just came up. It was just grand. And again, I'll never forget. Thank you so much for everything that you do up there.
All right. Thanks for sharing the story, Dean. Appreciate that. There are lots of programs. In fact, we were up there a few years ago during one of the Perseid meteor shower in August. Watching as they're pointing out objects in the sky. So lots of night programs at Crater Lake, like the one Dean was talking about.
Yes, in the campground every night there's a program. And then during the meteor showers, they take hikes up to the watchman. And the ranger who knows something about it will give night talks. Sometimes they'll set up telescopes up on the rim and look at certain things, and sometimes they'll take a hike.
And I have to point out too that the night we were up there watching for the meteor showers and stuff, the ranger was out there with his gigantic green laser, the kind that you get in trouble for using on planes, and pointing at things in the sky. And then midsummer fluke, a thunderstorm blew up and obscured the sky. So that was the end of the meteor shower observation for us. We have another call here. Let us go to John in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Crater Lake with Larry Smith.
Hi, yeah, John Lund. Yeah, I've done a lot of research on the history of skiing up there. And back in the 1927 to 38, there was a race from Fort Klamath up to the rim and back by skiers, mainly Scandinavians, a lot of them who skied down from Bend. The first race was 1927, 42 miles.
Wow. They
had a break trail up to the rim and back again. And then it took 7 hours, later on 5 hours, but there were 24 racers to begin with. And at the time, there was a big carnival at Fort Klamath, so 4,000 people showed up to do a little ski jumping, various games while they waited for the skiers to return. Another thing with skiing was there was a rope tow put up that a group of people would go up on Saturday morning, hook up the rope tow on the south rim, haul people up to the rim and down again, and then Sunday night they'd have to take the rope tow down and hide the equipment in the brush.
Wow, that's quite a history of skiing up. That's amazing, though. 42 miles to ski from Fort Klamath up to the rim and made it there and back in 7 hours?
Yeah, well, later on, one of them made it in 5 hours. There were two trophies that were given, two large trophies for people who won it twice. And one of those is here up at Eugene. The other one is actually in northern Finland, was given to the Finnish ski team back in the 70s and is held symbolically at a ski race up in Umea in northern Finland. So we're represented around the world.
That's a great story. Thanks for that, John.
And you've written a book or two.
Yeah, I wrote a cross-country ski book, and then on the trails in southern Oregon, and as part of it, I give the history of the Crater Lake race in the back.
And I read that, and that's where I learned about it, and we sold it up in the park for years.
Yes, you did. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, John. Good to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Quite a bit of winter sports in the lake, which raises the question about when in the research you've done into your history, Larry, people actually did begin camping at Crater Lake in the winter, or did they always? Were there always some hardy souls who made that trek in the winter?
There were always hardy souls. These were photographers, mostly, that came up there to try to take a look at the lake in the wintertime. And B.B. Bowski was a Polish guy that came up there, and he set up a camp and right where the lodge is today, and he's never been found.
Really?
Yeah, they found his camera, they found his camping equipment, but they've never found him. It's one of the great mysteries of what happened to this guy. So sometimes those that went out by themselves never came back.
Is there a chance he got too close to the rim, perhaps?
Went down probably in a ball of avalanche.
Wow. And nobody ever goes down there and looks for bones, I presume.
Well, by the time they discovered him, they didn't even know where he was at. They just found his camp set up by where the lodge is today.
All right, so that's winter camping. Just the regular summer season, folks, though, in the heart of tourist season. We talked about cars showing up, a decade and a half or so into the 20th century. When did the first RV-type things begin to show up?
Well, they were putting them onto Model A's, and the Model A's were showing up in the 20s. And so they had them set up in such a way that they had all the anemones hooked right onto them. And you'll notice that in the pictures, they always have the Model A, and then the tent was hooking right to it and went out from it. So I don't know if they were bedding down or they just used a support system, but they just parked all over the rim area once they got up there. And they brought everything, including the kitchen sink, with them now that they had a car.
Right. Was there a lot of environmental degradation from people driving all over Crater Lake in the early years of cars and trucks?
It was when they finally got the three C's up there, they were able to
start the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yes, mm-hmm. they were able to start building areas where the curbing and so on, where you could keep the people out. You can see in some of the pictures, they were just driving all over the place, and it just became a sea of dust. And when the three C's came up there, they built curbing. They paved the area, put in sidewalks, promenades, rock walls, and campsites, actually identified campsites, and then people had to stay within those.
And so when was the trail built down to Cleetwood Cove for the boats?
Well, the first one was in front of the hotel, and it went down right directly in front of the hotel. In fact, Peter Britt took a picture of it going down. And that was used up until 1924. And then in 1924, it was moved over to the front of where the cafe building is today. Mm-hmm. I went down that when I was 7.
Really?
Yeah, my twin brother and I. And then that was there until 1960. And then my brother was on the team that built the new one on the other side, and they opened it in 61.
Over at Cleetwood Cove?
Yeah.
How do the boats get into the lake? Are they helicoptered in now?
They did it three different ways. Mm-hmm. They slid them over different times. And up until the 60s, they were still sliding them down. Then they built two boats on the island, and that took 2 years. And then they now are using helicopters.
Built two boats on Wizard Island, really. Mm-hmm. That's a hard place to build a boat. I could just imagine, like, where's that tool? Geez, we didn't bring that with us.
Can you imagine the commute? You have to drive 11 miles around, walk a mile down, take a 6-mile boat ride, and reverse in the evening. And that's why it took 2 years to build them. They had a generator over there, and just as they finished up the last boat, the generator caught the boathouse on fire, and part of the island burned.
Oh, no.
It was really it was a visual disaster. Trees 300 years old went down. I was working there when it went down.
Really? And so was Wizard Island a much more forested place?
Yes,
than
it was.
We, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You couldn't even find the boathouses. Now you can see the boathouses very easily.
Wow. And so then you get into the whole change in environmental ethic within the federal agencies, including in this case the National Park Service. I mean, so was there talk of replanting the island? Was it attempted?
No.
Was it just left alone?
They're coming up. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what's happening over there. But it is rocky soil. You just can't go in there and just plant anything. But in the duff and the trees that are rotting there, new trees are coming up. So in about 300 years, we'll see it again.
We'll have to stick around long enough.
And these were all Shasta firs and noble firs, so they're slow growing.
The amenities now, in the time that you've been connected to Crater Lake and living in the area, obviously many more things have changed. A lot of the development now pulled back away from the rim just a little bit because of environmental concerns. Is that process finished? Is it still underway?
Yes, and down at Mazama Campground, they've actually added hookups, which is something that the park never had. They have showers, and people would come in and say, Ranger, do you have showers? Yes, every time it rains. And so the park didn't have showers until the late 80s and for campers. But now there is talk of maybe reopening the Rim Campground, which is a picnic area, mm-hmm. and making it into maybe for bicycles and people who are walk-in campgrounds so they can be right on the rim.
But low-impact camping.
Yeah, and so that's being thought about, but you can see from the pictures that it's growing back compared to what it used to be up there. So,
and I can see from the pictures, and that's a big benefit of having Larry here in the studio with me. So for the folks who do want to see the pictures, in addition to getting the audio descriptions they've heard during this program.
134 pictures.
All right, and when is the you're giving this on Saturday, 10 in the morning?
Yes, and it will be a give and take. People are encouraged to bring their items that they had used for camping or some relic or something like that. There will be research at the library, and so I'll be there from 10 until 12 talking about the pictures. And then the Southern Oregon Historical Society is going to bring out from their collection. Oh, I went down to take a look. They even have the chains that went around the tires of these cars.
Really?
That I'm showing pictures of. And they are going to be having camping equipment and the kits that were used and the little cross X camp stools.
Uh-huh. Oh, sure, yeah.
I wish we went back to those. It was a lot easier to haul around.
So this is all on Saturday at the Southern Oregon Historical Society History Center in Medford.
Yes, the old Penny's building.
Okay. Larry Smith, always good to see you. Take care of yourself.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks for joining us.